prop comedy styles are a specialty thing. They range from the arrows through the head of early Steve Martin to Gallagher's giant doorknobs and melon smashing, but there is certainly no comic working today who uses props as inventively and exhaustively and to better effect than one Scott Thompson, better known as Carrot Top. He recently celebrated 8 years at the Luxor here in Las Vegas. He was once something like the picked-on younger brother to other comics who made fun of the use of prop comedy and the ever-evolving physical presence, but Carrot Top seems to at last have been embraced by the comedy establishment. How much so, you may ask? Well, Dennis Miller, whose comedy is quite distant from prop comedy, recently admitted to Scott that his son is his biggest fan. Score one for the redhead. Carrot Top, yeah. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here.
And everything you said was very accurate. You know, it did start with Steve Martin with the arrow in the head and the Gallagher, which is really strange. I just saw Gallagher this past weekend. He was emceeing a wedding for a friend of ours, Amazing Jonathan's wedding. And he's still funny. I mean, the guy's still great.
He's still got his wits.
Yeah, he's really always been a funny guy.
Mm. Often performing artists find out they're good at something early in life. You know, most comedians discover as kids. You know, and you've described yourself as the class clown. You know, kids discover that they're funny and there's just something that they're really good at. But it seems to me prop comedy is not necessarily.
It's still a dying breed. Yeah. It really, honestly, is a kind of comedy that you don't see a lot of people doing it. Now I keep saying, where's the next Carrot Top? There hasn't been. You know, Gallagher came along and Rip Taylor and all this, and then, but there hasn't been another prop comic that I'm aware of that since I've started. And I don't know if it just means that no one wants to do it. You know, it is harder.
Maybe it's tough to do.
It's tough to do with, for me, it's all I know. But when I first started doing the clubs, the biggest joke with other comics was like, yeah, what are you going to drag this stuff around the country the rest of your life? And I said, yeah, it's like dragging my amp. You know, it's like dragging my guitar. It's my props. It's my show. So I never looked at it as an inconvenience to drag the stuff around. That was what I did.
That's what you did.
And then until I saw the other comics just walk in and walk out, you know, and they could go do, you know, spots here and there and run down another club, it was more convenient for them. But I always loved having my stuff, so I never thought about it. I didn't care.
Do you remember the first prop that you used?
Yes, I do. The first prop that I ever used wasn't one that I wrote. It was one that I made a joke about it, but it was a neighborhood crime watch sign that was in the neighborhood, and I had taken it. And I remember it was in my dorm in college, and everyone would come in and comment, say, "Where'd you get the neighborhood crime watch sign?" I said, "Yeah, how good is crime watch when I'm watching their signs?" So I went on stage with that, and that was my opening line. Sorry, I'm late. It was in the neighborhood, and I said, "How good is crime watch if they're not even watching the signs?" It took me an hour and a half to unbolt the sign right in the middle of everybody. So that was a really good little visual, and everyone loved it, and they laughed. And then,
how old were you when you did that?
I was probably 22.
22 to Taylor to college?
Yeah, I did the college, yeah. Wow. And then the first time I went to an actual comedy club, which was the real deal, that was way rougher.
Was it something where you're just kind of driving around town and you see that and suddenly the idea clicks? Really?
Well, that's what that one did. Mm-hmm. I just thought, a neighborhood crime watch, I'm going to take that sign.
Yeah.
And I don't encourage kids to take things. I was young. I was a rebel back then, you know, stole signs. But, I thought of it. I always thought observationally. I thought that was there was something funny about that. And there was another one. I had a whole bunch of. After that, I did a couple more signs. And there was like one that said "Slow children at play," and they didn't have any feet. And I said, "Well, no wonder they're slow. They don't have any feet."
They don't have any feet.
So it was all these different signs that I thought were funny. So I put this little routine together with signs, and then.
What's observational comedy, but with props,
rather
than Jerry Seinfeld describing
exactly.
Something.
Exactly. That's a great way to kind of breaking what I do down. One of my favorite ones I did was the paper cups and string phone. You know, when you're a kid, you're talking to the phone, a cup. And I said, we need an updated version of this. And so another cup came out for call waiting, you know, say, hey, another call. And that was like my big break prop. Like it went on the Tonight Show with it. I did everything. Everybody's like, that was clever and funny and, you know, could be broken down into a verbal.
Yeah, describing this, you could have done verbal observational comedy.
Yeah.
But how do you break this down into props? How do you think visually like that?
Yeah, I don't know. That's just how I thought of it when I started doing comedy. I never thought. Nowadays, I do write more. I do write both. I do try to write up stand-up routines as well without props. In fact, the live show has got I can go for like, there's a 20-minute break from props in my live show here at Vegas where I don't touch a prop and I just talk for 20 minutes. So that kind of has evolved, I guess, in the more time that I've been on stage, kind of getting that comfort level to kind of escape from the props for a bit and just talk, you know.
But when you are working with the props, why do you think you gravitate toward them? I mean, what is it about your outlook on the world that leads you that way?
I like that vision. Well, like I said, I don't really need to. It's just that I've noticed with the show now, but I like it. I've always wanted to have. I used to describe it as like show and tell. It's like when you're in school and you go to show and tell. A class where they would have visual aids, and the teacher would be talking, saying, "Now we're going to talk about water," and you should be holding up the water. Everybody paid attention more because it was something you had to listen and watch. And so I always thought when I was in a club, it was like the same thing. It was like, as I always say, it's like show and tell with liquor, you know, it's even better. So there was comics after comic, and then I came up and I was like, "Hey, look, it's a thing, the thing." And they kind of have to pay attention because there was stuff coming out of the trunk. So it was just another a visual aid that maybe might help.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, talk a little bit, if you would, about the process of writing jokes that involve this. I mean, I gather you know, as you say, you're not liberating crime watch signs anymore.
Yeah, indeed.
So you've got, well, case in point, you've got one prop that includes red, yellow, and green lanterns, the punchline being traffic light.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you come up with things
Like that? Well, that's interesting. I know exactly where I was when I thought of that. I went to a Halloween store here in Vegas, and there were these cute little lanterns. And I said, there's something funny about a lantern. And I sat there for like 15 minutes in the store just staring at the lantern. And there's something funny about it. What is the thing? What is the joke? And they were just clear lanterns. And I picked up another one. And then I picked up three. And I said, well, that would be a traffic. If I painted them different, I had to paint the gels. I went and got the gel, whatever. And then I glued them all together. And I said, that's an Amish traffic light. Like, and then I walked out. And the guy was like, you just come up with that? And I said, yeah. So a lot of times I force myself to, if I see something really funny looking, I might brainstorm and try to find something about it. And then sometimes things will just come to me. Like an easier one would be like the Kardashians had a baby. So I said, okay, get a baby and put a big butt on it. So it's pretty easy. But it's visually very funny when you hold it up and they go, hey, that's a Kardashian's baby. Yeah. Yeah.
But then, and then with Kardashian's baby, with the Amish traffic light, with others, you build your props, all of them by hand.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
Boy, that's got to be a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. But you know, what's crazy about that too is locating the stuff as well. Like when I think of something, I go and I'm going to search to find the stuff. And a lot of it is just trying to find the actual items to put together to make the prop. And then when you make it, then you have to present it and do it on stage and get the beats down so it actually is funny. You know?
So well, take us into the workshop. I mean, what do we see if we go into your workshop where you're putting
a lot of unfunny stuff that never worked, just laying around in piles. And then, just a little desk and a little saw and some glue and duct tape. And it's my warehouse is actually quite fun to walk through because it's years and years of stuff that used to be in the show and stuff that never worked in the show. Prototypes that are still kind of, that I'm sitting there looking at. I've had a few that I've been trying to work on.
Heavy machinery, drill presses.
Absolutely. All kinds of stuff. Yeah, it's a real workshop because it takes a lot. I have a guy that at the Luxor that I've commissioned when I need a really hard prop. He helps me build. Yeah.
So what's the prop that's sitting in that workshop that you know has something really great, but it hasn't come out yet?
There's a whole bunch of those, actually. And there's been ones that I've tested and tried, and they just don't work. I don't know why. You know, I've had this thing where I try a prop on television, and it kills, does great, brings the house down. Then I bring it back to the show, and it doesn't do anything. And that's happened a lot of times, and I even have them called, they're just called TV props. These are just ones, I don't know if it's just because the camera zooms in and they can see it really well, or if it's just, I usually think it's more of a visual thing. I think in the audience, the theater's so large, they can't quite see I'm holding up. Yeah. So on television, the camera zooms in, they're all watching it on the screen.
If you're going to give us an example of that, something that works on TV or not at the live show or vice
one,
versa.
I'm trying to think of one. It was a party favor. You know, you blow on it, the little thing goes out. Well, I made one for people that have asthma, so then when they could blow on their party favor, but still suck on the air. So I built this little asthma thing built into a party favor, and then on New Year's Eve, I think I was on the Tonight Show. It was leveled, and then I brought it back to the show, and it didn't get anything.
And
if it was just hard to see, or if it was just I don't know, or the TV audience was just more pumped up, or. That's a mystery. I don't know.
Well, a lot of props. You mentioned Gallagher. A lot of props are outsized. I mean, that's his stock and trade.
His was always the big stuff. Yeah, the big couch that he would jump on and whatnot. And it's funny because I always admired Gallagher, Zach, but I never, when I started doing my act, coming up with it, it was completely a different kind of thought process, you know? It wasn't the more visual word gags like, Oh, like the big couch. That was, to me, that's a prop, but that's not, it wasn't really funny. It was just a big couch, and he jumped on it. He made it fun by jumping on it. But all of my stuff is, I always tried to make it more inventive. You know, one of my favorite comics was George Carlin, and he was brilliant because he would mix stupidity with really clever stuff. He could talk about the most clever stuff and then talk about, like, picking your nose. And it was unbelievable how he could do both in one breath.
And he did it. You know, do the stupid stuff from an intelligent perspective.
Yeah, I try to keep the show, I mean, the silly, definitely silly parts to it. But then at the end, I always say the underlining thought that people leave, that which people have told me. They say, you know, your show is really clever. Like, you don't give yourself credit, but it's a very clever show. And I'm like, okay, that's good. I've always wanted them to leave thinking that.
We are talking with Carrot Top.
Yeah.
He has been at the Luxor for 8 years now, recently celebrated his 8th anniversary.
Crazy,
there,
huh?
And he's headlining at the Luxor through 2015. Speaking of the response you get from audiences, we were looking at some Yelp reviews of your show at the Luxor, and there was this one theme that came up over and over again, which is, I didn't expect this guy to be as funny as he
was. Yeah, I get that a lot, yeah. I don't know how do you break that down? People say, "Hey, you look a lot better. You look a lot better in person than you do on TV." I was like that weird too. Like, what does that mean? I look like crap on TV? Like, well, yeah, kind of. You know, television makes you do. You know, I think I'm guilty of that as well. I see people in person, I'm always like, wow, they look so much different. But at least it's better. You know, sometimes with the filters on television, they could say you look like crap in person. So, yeah, I don't know. I get that. Honestly, I guess that's one of the most common things that have said to me when I go out. I'm somewhere on a plane or wherever at a restaurant. Someone will walk over and say, "We saw your show. Oh my God, I didn't think it was going to, I didn't know what to expect. I didn't think it was going to be that good." I always get that. I go, "Oh, well, that's good." So, I guess they go in and think it's going to be crap.
I
don't know.
They're coming into the theater. What are their expectations?
I don't know. Or they got drugged there. I mean, that does happen, you know. Like, and they'll tell me that, too. I get that a lot. It's like, yeah, I didn't want to come at all. My mom was going to drug me. And sometimes it happens when I go out into the audience and I say, "Hey, how you guys, you know, thanks for coming," and I make a joke about, you know, what you couldn't get tickets to, so you're at my show. And sometimes they're brutally honest and they go, "Yeah, we really didn't want to come to this, but we did and we're having a good time." I'm like, okay. Wish I hadn't said it out loud, but yeah. But I guess, you know, it is what it is, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But at least they like it. You know, it could be where they got drugged there and it was worse than they thought, you know? Or someone said, "Oh, this, you got to see Carrot Top. It's a great show." And then they go and they're like, "Ugh, it was unwatchable," you know?
You've spoken of being the class clown when you were younger.
Yeah.
What was your family upbringing like? Were you in a place
where it
could come out?
No. The strangest thing about that is my father worked at the Space Center, NASA. He's an engineer. Couldn't be more straight-laced engineer business, just, you know, not, although
it's
funny. I get my wit from my
Washington,
dad.
Washington, D.C.?
Cape Canaveral.
Cape Canaveral.
Yeah.
Okay.
But my dad's funny. My dad was a great storyteller, still is, a good storyteller. So he tells a joke. He does the whole, I mean, his delivery is impeccable. And I think I picked that up when I was a kid, watching my dad tell jokes to his friends and whatnot. And my mom was just a, you know, free spirit, you know, house mom, kind of did odd things as we got older, different jobs. But I never was a show business family. Nowhere close in my entire family tree, I think, is there any in show business.
So what was dinner like at the Thompson household?
It was very quiet. Yeah, no, it was. Yeah, it was like a normal family. Yeah, and I never was really outspoken. I was very quiet. I wasn't a. When you use the word class clown, insinuates you're running around, you're crazy, or you know. But I was really quiet. I kind of was more of an observer. I just kind of sat back and waited for the punchline. You know, like, I remember this, like, it was yesterday. We were having dinner. My mom poured me and my brother milk. And I remember I took a sip of it, and I said, "Oh, Mom, I don't think this milk's good." And she said, "Oh, give me that." And she put chocolate mix in it and gave it back to me. And I remember thinking, well, now it's bad chocolate milk. What is that? That honestly happened. I never forget that. My mom just looked at me like, "What?" And I go, "Well, now, how did that think that was going to fix the problem? Like, she just put chocolate mix in there." So I go, "Mom, now it's chocolate spoiled milk." And she's like, "Well, you know, I was kind of."
Quite
so I was. She was hoping that her kids were stupid, maybe. But I was like, "Mom, I'm just dumb."
She was a comedian too.
Yeah. So I mean, we really had, you know, and then I don't think it got into me doing really humor things until my brother and I are both swimmers, and I remember I hated swimming and hated it, just horrified of the water. I just did everything, I didn't like it. And as my brother got good at it, he went like every day, you know, the swim team kind of thing. I hate it. So I would get up on the diving board and pull my bathing suit all the way up over my chest and all the way down over my knee. You know, just stupid being physical. You know, like, look, I'm going to jump in the water. And I was always, that's what it started was, I remember at the pool. And the coach would say, Scott, get off the diving board and do your laps. And then I would, you know, I'd do my laps, but I'd swim like sideways over the other lanes, just being stupid. And then that was it. And I said, you don't have to be in a swimmer. So then I went to the marching band. I played drums.
You went to the marching band from there.
So I like being in, I like doing the public. I like doing in front of people. So the drums was kind of performance and kind of, and I was kind of the clown of the band, kind of in a sense.
But
too.
Playing drums and being the clown of the band is very different from being a quiet observer.
Well, yes, indeed. That was the first, I guess, breaking out, I guess, you know, or I wasn't going to sit back and I wanted to be. I will say that I remember being the circle of like telling jokes. My dad's jokes, I would go to school the next day and they would say, what's your joke during lunch? And I'd have everybody in a circle and I'd be telling jokes. So that I remember, I was always the leader as far as mm-hmm. telling jokes and entertaining.
Who gave you early encouragement and said, you know what? You could do a lot with this. You're really good at this.
You know, I'm trying to think if I ever had someone that was an actual one person, because I remember my parents were always big always supporters of whatever I did. When I did comedy, I wasn't around them. I'll never forget this. I remember I went to college, and that's when it all happened. There was an open mic, and I went up and told jokes, just like I did at school. You know, old jokes. You know, knock knock, whatever. And it was great. Everybody loved it. And I came off, and they were like, all my roommates were like, that was awesome. And they had one next semester, and I did that one. So then the third one came around. I said, I think I should make this more about the school and come up with some actual jokes as opposed to just jokes that people have heard. So that's when I came on stage, and I said, I had an orange wig on over this hair. They said, please welcome Carrot Top. And I remember I came up with a name. I came up with the whole thing. In fact, I had a logo before I had the act.
I was going to ask you about that. You were a marketing major in college.
Yeah.
And that makes perfect sense. You got the logo for your act before.
I literally drew a logo before I even had an act, before I even went on stage. I wanted it to be a comedian. And I've never been on stage yet, and I already had a logo. So silly. But I was a visionary. So
yes,
then when
were.
I went up and did the opening joke was, hey, please welcome Carrot Top. I came on and I had this big orange wig on and people were kind of like, okay, is that the joke? And then I pulled it off and my hair was like this. And they were like, oh, my God. And I said, it's not funny now. This is real. So that was my opening joke. And then the Crime Watch and then I picked on the school. It was kind of a little routine. But then that's when I went back to my parents and I remember saying, I'm doing comedy. And my dad was like, what do you mean doing comedy? I said, like at the school, I'm doing like little comedy shows. And he's like, oh, you're not funny. What do you mean? What do you mean comedy shows? And I said, you got to come down and check it out, you know? So my dad came down and he's like, what the heck? He couldn't believe it. He's like, I had a little, you know, like 100 people out there and I was doing my little gags and my act. And my dad was like, that's pretty good. Like no one knew. My parents never knew that I had this in me or wanted to do this or pursue it. And then it was just kind of silly. It was just that's what I was doing at college. Then I graduated, and I said, well, I guess I'm going to do some comedy until I can figure out what I want to do for a living, you know? Mm-hmm. So my dad's like, well, what does that mean? You're going to do comedy? Like, you can make a living at that? And I said, well, I can, you know, I guess. I mean, there was like, you know, clubs lined up. That was just enough to pay the bills that I had. You know, I had a little truck, and I had, you know, food expenses, and I had, that's it.
Clearly from the very beginning, you're just describing early time on stage with the orange wig and all, and then voila, there you are.
Yeah.
You have a very distinctive look.
Yes.
I mean, you don't have body doubles,
as
I imagine.
As my neighbor's mom used to always say, you're just unusual, Scott, an unusual look about me. And all the other kids would go, Mom, that's mean. Don't say, well, he's unusual.
Unusual. How important is that to the brand, to your
comedy? Oh, I think
comedy?
it's 50% of it. I mean, I really do think. I think there's a strong part of the whole package that worked because I had this unique look. Unique is better, I guess, than peculiar, unusual. But, yeah, it's a unique look. And I think like that with a lot of entertainers or actors or whoever, artists, you see them, they do have I was watching an actor last night on TV. I said, you can't just mistake who this guy is. He's got the big eyes. Mm-hmm. Steve Buscemi, I think his name was.
Yeah, yeah.
I said, you can't mistake who that is, you know, and same with this. You know, people are like, well, you know, I walk through the mall, it's like, yeah, it's not, you know, it's Carrot Top. Even if I put a hat on, it's still have a distinctive look about you, I guess.
But. Yeah, well, but at the same time, though, you've altered your physical appearance through the years. For a while, you wore makeup, you've gained
a lot. I still wear makeup, yeah.
But, well, you've gained.
As my nephew says, people say, how come your uncle wears makeup? He says, he's in show business, dummy. Well, that's the only reason you get into show business, to wear women's panties and eyeliner. That's why I do this.
So you could do this.
Yeah.
But you have things like putting on and losing muscle, you know, things of that sort.
Yeah, I was kind of up. It's funny. I've always worked out. In fact, my crew and I, we always loved that joke. We look back at my pictures of me when I, 20 years ago, and I'm exactly the same that I am right now. But yeah, a couple of years back, I went through this. I was like crazy. I wanted to be a bodybuilder. And I don't even know why. It was just, I moved to Vegas. It was right when I got this gig, because I had not a lot to do during the day. It was like, do a show at night, and then what do? Hang out with Wayne Newton? Probably not. So I said, I'm just going to go to the gym. So it would be like a three-hour gym, you know, workout, just to kill the day, to time. And I got into this whole, like, yeah. And then all of a sudden one day I was like, I don't want to be a bodybuilder. This is silly. So, yeah, I went back to the original Carrot Top.
Could you do what you do if you looked like Joe Everyman?
Well, I did it for a few years, and it worked, but Gene Simmons, actually, of all people from KISS, actually, one time said that, you're very muscular. And I said, yeah. He says, does that affect your comedy? Like, you with your muscles, does that change who you are on stage? And I was like, no, not really, I don't think. I mean, the crowd, you know, they never, I think my fans might have went, oh, wow, the guy's going through people do that. I see actors that are in shape or not in shape. But to an extreme, yeah, so... Then it was too much of an extreme, so I went back to I like being the skinny little Carrot Top. It works better. It does work better, I think, for my image and my persona.
We're talking with the scary...
Scary-looking, with makeup on. He wears makeup to radio.
Close. We're talking with the skinny little Carrot Top, who is headlining at the Luxor through 2015. I mentioned in the intro you've been headlining at the Luxor for over 8 years. We saw an interview with you prior to your arrival here, and you had expressed some reservations about moving to Las Vegas. What caused you to hesitate at that point? Did you just not want to be locked into something?
Yeah, I just didn't know if it was something I was not something that I was familiar with and never done in my career. I've always been on the road. I was a road guy. So I was always on the road, in the bus, in Kansas City, then in Iowa, then Detroit, just on the road. And we'd do weeks at a time here at the MGM back in the day. It's kind of like what some of the acts knew, you know, come in for 2 weeks and be gone for 3 months, come back for 2 weeks. So it was about 10 to 12 weeks a year in and out of Vegas at the MGM. So when they came and said, how about every night, you know, a residency, a full-time residency, I had reservations about it. I just didn't know what if I was going to be able to do it or if it was something I would enjoy. I'd never been in one place. I had my house in Florida, so I was like, that means I'd have to move here. So there's a lot to, you know, kind of think about and take in.
Well, has it been paradise?
And the pressure
for you? Has it been paradise for you?
Oh, I love it. Yes, but it was also as any actor, you know, I'm paranoid about everything, you know, making sure that I could pull it off too. I mean, I'm there every night. Are people going to come every night? It took a while to get transitioned into doing that every night. Now I can't imagine not doing this here. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine, you know. And then getting a home too, that helped. Getting out of the hotel and getting an actual home and having that feeling of regularity, you know. So,
we spoke with another comic not too long ago who said Las Vegas is Broadway when it comes to comedy and such. And do you look at it that way? And if so, I mean, do you foresee a day, maybe someday, where Wayne Newton calls you in and puts hands on you and says, "You, Carrot Top,
are the new
Mr. Las Vegas"?
Yeah. Well, I think whoever that comic was about being Broadway, there is something to be said about that. I mean, it's Broadway's Broadway, but I mean,
Louis Anderson.
It was Louis. I love Louis. Well, I can see Louis saying that. It's like Broadway. Carrot, come here. Sorry, just blew out the engineer in there. Sorry, I was going to do my Illyrian impression. Sorry. But no, he's a dear friend. But yeah, it is like Broadway. Of course, Broadway, though, is Broadway. Vegas is, I think, the two different things. But it's in a sense, it's like a Broadway-type thing where, yeah, this is pretty cool. Like, a lot of people would love to play Vegas and have a show here. So it is indeed awesome.
Now, but it's six shows a week. How do you keep it fresh, and even for yourself? What percentage of your show is new each night?
Well, there's something every night. Well, one part of the show that's new every night is just the audience is always new and the energy is always different. That is a given. So the show will always have a different feel to it, and even your own performance will have an impact because I'm a perfectionist, so every night is like, you know, you come off and I'm like, okay, well, you know, I rate it. Okay, that was a 7. That was a 6. It was a 5. The other night we had a 9, and you know, I called a road show. I came off and I said, it was like a road show. You know, it was like being on the road and all your fans were screaming and it was just tap dancing the whole way. Then this night you're like, okay, we never worked really much together as an audience and as an act. And in my eyes, audiences, for the most part, think it was the best thing they've ever seen. I've had friends, I've had relatives that are the most honest people that would tell me, and they say it was always the crowds don't. You're doing, unless you tell them, you know, if you say you guys are horrible and this is horrible. I mean, you know what I mean? Then they don't know. But you know.
How often do you run across a horrible audience?
Well, there's people that see there's such a thing as a horrible audience. Mm-hmm. The people that think there's no such thing, and some people think there is. I've always said there's an energy. I don't necessarily the crowd's bad. But I've had a performance that I'm just not on. I'm not clicking my words. I'm skipping. I'm not. You know what I mean? It's not good. You might have people talking. You might have people sleeping. You might have a lot of movement. You might have someone that you know that got sick in the audience. So you don't even know till after the show. I'm like, how come the crowd was so? Someone got sick and they had to wheel them out. So there's a lot of variables that go into having the right audience and the best show.
When you tell a joke and it doesn't work, is there usually a common reason that timing's off, prop falls apart, just something like that?
There's all kinds of things, sure. There's a lot of it with prop comedy, and only my crew that works with me every night knows this. It's like if you literally hesitate for a second, you go to grab it and it hesitate and it like falls or it does one little second off of its thing, it won't work. I'll say, hey, here's a thing with a oop and a drop, and pick it back up. No. It happens all the time, and it's the strangest thing. But same with a verbal joke too. I mean, I can do a joke every night, and it works. And then there's one night it doesn't, and it does mystify you. And I think about it right then. I'm like, why didn't that work? What did I do wrong?
When that happens, do you drop the joke right away? Do you try rewriting it?
One of my favorite persons in people in comedy who was his biggest strength was with Johnny Carson was when something bombed, he made it work with his. Oh. In fact, it was better when it bombed. Yeah, it was how he got out of it.
Right, the timing was so.
So I love that, good. I try to do that kind of thing. It's saving a joke, and that was Carson's brilliant thing. He would do these jokes, and it was just. He would be like a joke would be like, Mr. Clean died of ammonia. I did not know that. And then the crowd wouldn't laugh. And he'd go, see ammonia, Ed. And then he'd do another, like another take on it. And then three times. And then finally the crowd would laugh because he's like, see, because ammonia, he died of ammonia. And that, you know what I mean? He's saving it. So that's awesome as long as it's not every joke.
Yeah.
If your whole act is that, then you're in trouble. So, yeah, when you have those ones that just for some reason they don't work, then if you save it, that's awesome. And every comic is... loves to try to say it.
Well, with Carson, what you remember is that some nights it was just so bad that the piano player started T for two and he'd begin tap dancing.
Exactly.
And that was how you knew.
Exactly.
And that's what you remember.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is remarkable.
Yeah.
What's the oldest bit in your show right now?
The oldest bit in my show might be my Wendy's girl thing. I have a little thing where I put my hair in pigtails and I go, look, it's the Wendy's girl. And I call it my free bird. I guess Carrot Top's greatest hit because it's the one been going. So that's probably the one and people, that's like my free bird. So they always like it and it's always silly and it's, you know.
And it always works.
It always works. That one always does work. Yeah. Always.
So, and that's why you keep it.
Yeah. It's your go-to.
It's your go-to. Yeah. Have you ever seen another comic steal your material, either style just like
yours? Oh, absolutely. Which is funny because with prop comedy, you wouldn't think.
You wouldn't think so.
No, and what's great about that, when I was starting up in the ranks going through the clubs, that was one of the things that. When other comics would make fun of me, I used to come back and say, well, at least I'm not stealing, you know, because that was one of the biggest things is people stealing your act. And I said, well, at least you got to give me that. At least I'm doing my original. I'm not stealing anyone's act. I'm doing my original thing, which to this day I've always thought I kind of created an original kind of art form of prop comedy. But
any big-name comedians who sort
of
pulled Crime
Watch
sign?
Well, no, there wasn't necessarily big-name comedians that have taken my jokes, but TV shows. Mm-hmm. Like the Tonight Show, when they used to do it with Jay. They don't do it with Fallon yet, but they used to do this thing where, you know, high school, tonight we're going to look through high school souvenirs or something it was called. So he would go through this table of different invention props. And I noticed that they came up with that whole bit after I'd been doing the Tonight Show with him, because Jay always said, I love all the prompts, I need the prompt thing. And then the writers were like, when I would do my thing, they were like, we should come up with a thing for Jay for that. So when Jay started doing it, I said to Jay, when you do that prop thing, and he hates doing it. He hated doing it. He'd walk through it, and he hated it. I said, let me do it. Now it's time for so-and-so inventions and Carrot Top. So Carrot Top's corner. And he always loved the idea, but then he never did it. But there was only a couple times where, you know, they call it parallel thinking. It wasn't necessarily – they ripped me off on purpose. It was like – one of them was a the George Foreman – remember Mike Tyson when he bit the ear off of – Holyfield.
Right. Infamous moment.
Right. Yeah. So I said, have you seen the George Foreman has the grill? Have you seen the George Foreman grill? And I'd hold it up. Have you seen the Mike Tyson's grill? And it was a George Foreman grill with an ear on it. Like, it was silly, but have you seen the new George and Mike Tyson has a grill out, you know? So it killed on the Tonight Show. I did it. And then 2 months later, they're doing something on the show, and they did the exact same thing. So I was like, well, that was kind of my friend called me. They just did your joke, like the exact joke.
Imitation is the sincerest form
of
television.
Sure. Yeah.
Fred Allen.
Yeah.
We're talking with Carrot Top. He is headlining at the Luxor through 2015. When you were younger and getting into the comedies, you said there aren't that many prop comedians who date back a long way. So who were your comic influences? Yeah, I mean, you talked about your dad's timing and his ability to tell a story.
Yeah, George Carlin was definitely
– Carlin.
I remember he had his HBO specials, and I remember watching those. And he kind of reminded me of my father in a bit. My dad's cadence and even his haircut and his way Carlin stood and is slouched, that was my father. So I think that we really – and he was just so observational. His humor was just smart. And then Richard Pryor and Bill Cosby's routines, I remember that because I had the albums. And then that's what the album was first. Then we got into the thing. And then, you know, believe it or not, Gallagher was the only prop comic that I ever watched. But it wasn't his props that amazed me. It was his stand-up. He has an album, believe it or not, and it's probably, 30 years old. It's black and white. It's just his face on it. It says Gallagher. And I listened to that thing probably 100 times when I was a kid. And it was all those jokes like, why do you drive in a parkway and park in a driveway? Mm-hmm. You know, why do they call them buildings when they're done building them? They should call them builts. And it was always really funny, clever, smart stuff. And I used to think, God, that guy's brain is amazing. And then when you watch his act, his stand-up was still, it was brilliant. And then at the end, he'd start smashing watermelons. And I remember him saying in one of his specials, he even made a joke about that. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm gonna mess with your minds all night, and then I'm gonna hit a watermelon, like to be the stupidest thing in the world. You know what I mean? To leave you with the most stupidity in the world, yet just be brilliant for an hour and a half, and then be stupid.
Yes, and then he
and
hit
I think
a watermelon.
There was the reasoning behind that. I think that was his whole plan. He's really smart. I think his plan was be smarter than the crowd, and actually get him at the end by smashing fruit on him, and them loving it. But his brain, if you go back and listen to his albums, he was great. So to go back, that he was one of my – and timing, you know, that's I think more of anything, when young comics ask me advice, I always say you have to find your voice. You have to find out what it is that you're going to be doing when you're up there, because people just want – I'm going to be a comic. And I say, okay, what are you going to do when you get up there? What's your platform? What is your repertoire? Is it going to be observational? Is it going to be dirty humor? Is it going to be men and women relationships? Or is it going to be a variety?
The comedy magician, Mary Sawchuk, was in a while back and talked about the idea of just the stagecraft of learning to take the stage. Just that.
That alone, absolutely.
That
yeah,
alone
sure. Yeah,
is
sure.
Something that takes a long time to learn.
Absolutely.
How did
right.
you learn your stagecraft? I mean, was it just
doing? I don't know, because I look back at early tapes and it was horrible. I mean, not that it's good now. I mean, it's just still horrible. But I mean, like when I watch myself, I don't know. There's a tape of me in the Bahamas at some club and it was hard to watch. I was like, I just kept saying, how we doing? And you know, I didn't have any... You know, I didn't have my self-confidence to just do my act. I just had to keep asking the crowd something. And now it's a horrible death. Don't do that. I do that still here. When you go to a show, if you ask the crowd too many questions too many times, like, they're not going to answer. They're you know, you find yourself, I'll say, how about NASCAR? Who likes NASCAR? No one will respond. Mm-hmm. So at the end of the show, I used to always say, why do I don't ask them questions? Just present it to as a statement. How about that NASCAR? I love NASCAR. Go into it. Don't. Who likes NASCAR? You know. And then you have to wait for the response. And then you, so then one person, I like NASCAR. And if you do that, then you go, okay, this next joke's just for you, since you're the only person that clapped. But, yeah, you try not to ask too many questions. But, yeah, finding that presence on stage, I don't remember now how it did, how I did it, but it took time. And I think that's another thing that I tell comics is the more time you get on stage, it sounds silly, but people always say, get up there and do it. They have to, you know.
It's such a, listening to you describe this, it's such a fascinating kind of a paradox, because on the one hand, you've got to have the self-confidence to get up there and just say, I'm gonna take the crowd, put the crowd in the palm of my hand. Get up there in general. And on the other hand, I mean, in listening to you talk about some of these older performances, watching them and seeing the flaws, seeing the things that you don't do anymore, the stagecraft, you know, early on. It reminds me of David Letterman is notorious. He's legendary for being so self-critical, being a perfectionist.
Absolutely.
You said you are, too.
Yeah, yeah. I know that about Letterman, for sure. And it's funny, I try not to get – sometimes I catch myself, and I try not to be that guy, because I think you can't be overcritical. I mean, I do that all the time. I have a show – you know, one show a week I'm happy with. And my friends are like, come on, have fun up there. And just – if you spend your whole day, and after the show, I hear he goes up and watches the tapes and just criticizes the whole thing. The day he's miserable. There's a small line in how much you should do that.
Did you do that when you first started?
I never go back and watch my tapes.
Never do.
No,
yeah.
No. I've watched him on television by accident. I'll be in somewhere and they'll be on.
Do you still get new satisfaction out of your craft?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's always the new Well, the satisfaction is with the new. If you do something new and it works. It's always a proud moment, and there's that satisfaction of if you really have a disconnect and you have that show where you walk off and go, that was fun. Like that was like being a kid again. That was really fun.
Have you ever thought about doing something else? Were you saying, yeah, I could try something different?
I don't know if it would be anything outside of this. I mean, I would love to, you know, do some more acting and some movies and whatnot. I think that'd be fun.
But if you did a movie, could you see yourself doing a serious role in a serious movie?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean,
yeah. No, I would
Andrew
love
Dice
to do.
Klain did that.
And, I would love to do a serious. I think every comic you ask would love to sink into something serious, because we're being funny.
Jim Carrey did that in a couple of movies. Dice Clay's in Blue Jasmine.
I've tried. There's a script that I've been working on with someone. I'm trying to. There's a really good meaty part of where I'm really a kind of a bad guy.
I don't know. Penn Jillette, I think, is crowdsourcing
movie
where he's going to be the villain.
Yeah,
the killer.
I did a thing for his last one, whatever it was. Penn's a mean guy or whatever. That one, yeah.
So yeah. That's, maybe that'll be a possibility.
Yeah, no, I love it.
One other thing was interesting, listening to the comics who inspired you, listened to as you were getting going, about half of them, Richard Pryor, George Carlin, and others, sort of found their voice as they got into really blue material. Bill Cosby has never never done blue.
No.
Your comedy's more or less PG rated. It's in
More or less. It's not really at all. I wouldn't say blue. It's a shade of blue, but at times. But it's never gone past that threshold of really offending anybody. But you know, I've seen comics that work blue that that are funny. I mean, it's not it's not to me. I've never looked at it like it's not. I think it's either like we're going back to what you're saying. Yeah, finding your voice. If you're gonna be blue. You know, that's your thing.
That's what you do. Yeah.
But I love watching all kind of comedy. I like clean comedy. I like the dirty stuff. I don't, you know.
Have you ever told a joke and then I regretted it because the audience you could just kind of hear it not going where you wanted it to?
I've tried to never do anything that was really
nothing offensive.
Well, no. Well, I had a joke one time every comic has had a moment probably they probably said something. Man, I shouldn't have done that. Or the crowd took it wrong, too. I've never talked about anything when it comes to tragedies. I mean, if there's some kind of tragedy, people, it's just not funny. In fact, one of the times that it worked in Deluxe, which was such a great bit, and I had to take it out because it just eventually lost its legs. But when that plane landed in the Hudson, remember, no one died.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was fine to talk about because there wasn't any death. And it was one of the funniest jokes. I said, we got the bodies exhibit at the top of the Titanic Museum. And I forgot how it's been so long now. I forgot the joke now, but it was like, now we're going to have the Hudson, whatever the hell exhibit, but it was something about it because no one died, we couldn't have it. You know, because everyone Titanic died. Everybody died. You know, died. Dead. No one died. So now we can't have. We had it all. You know, I forgot what it was, but that was always fine because it wasn't anyone that had dead.
Yeah, that sort of turns it upside down.
When there's
down.
Some tragedy involved, yeah. For most. I mean, most. I know friends. I have very close friends that are comics that are just the opposite. They go off stage that night and they tell a joke and you know too soon, kind of thing. But I've always been just in my own little world. I've never wanted to have people and feel uncomfortable mm-hmm. about that. Yeah. But I did one joke I thought was just silly. And I remember it because we were just talking about it the other night. I said, Ike Turner, I was in LA one time and I saw a car in the valet at my hotel and it said, the license plate was a personalized plate and it said IKTRNR. And I said, that's not really Ike Turner's car in the valet, is it? And the guy said, yeah, he stays here. I said, why would he have a license plate that said Ike Turner on it? And he's like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, if you just ask me, maybe the time that I know about Ike Turner, he wasn't a good guy, right? So I said, why would you want to advertise who you are if you're a bad guy driving around town? Hi, I'm Ike Turner. You know, I beat up my wife kind of thing, right? So the joke was when Ike Turner died, I said, they asked Tina Turner how Ike Turner died. She said, beats me. That was the joke that I went, is it too bad? Is it bad? You know, so I felt bad, but it was one of the, I thought it was clever, but at the same time, you know, it was horribly wrong. But
didn't hang on to that one for
no,
a long
I
time.
No, I got rid of it, but I remember thinking, that was a good joke, you know, and I've had a few jokes that I've written that wouldn't work for me, that would work for other friends. Mm-hmm. Just because that's how it is with comedy. You know, yeah. Sometimes I can do it, they can't.
I'd mentioned in the introduction that you've at times been the target of jokes from other comics. Why do you think that is?
Forever I was. Yeah. I still am sometimes. It's lessened now a little bit. And I have friends that have said this because, I think Louis actually said that. He said, probably because your longevity and how long, you know, it comes a time where they have to say, okay, he's earned his stripes kind of thing. You know, if you've done it for 30 years. So that's probably where it is now. I think people still, if they want to poke fun at me, it's probably just because they just have a thing about me, whatever it is. But I think when I first started out, I was, you know, I was successful and I was doing something different. And I was young and I was on television a lot. And they were just, these comics weren't on television. They were ripping me because the ones that were ripping me weren't on television.
The George Carlins
loved me in the, but I mean back then even.
Yeah,
back you know then. Jerry Seinfeld's, the Gary Shandling's, the Jay Leno's, they all loved me. David Letterman, they all that was you know Bill Maher. It was when you get on the internet and it would be these comics that are that I didn't know were just ripping me. So at the end of the day, it would make me feel a little better if I said, oh, Bill Maher made a joke about me. Well, Bill Maher's a friend of mine. Bill liked me. It would be different if it came from someone that I respected, admired, as opposed to some comic I've never known never done more than 10 minutes on stage kind of thing. You know, it's like I've been, you know, it kind of became, all right, I get it. I know. Yeah. But you get that a lot, I think, when you do something different. I mean, I think about that now with musicians. And if you think about it, the artists that have something different are the ones that get picked on more than the ones that just fall in line, you know. So
a lot of the comics that you just mentioned, I guess I would think of as really, really sharp. A lot of them observational, but very bright. And realizing you can't be slow-witted and be a really good comic, can you?
Well, that's what they say. I'm dumb as brick, so it worked for me. But
okay, yeah. It worked for you. Yeah. So you're the exception. Yeah, yeah. I see. Can you see yourself being anyplace else? I mean, do you think you may just be in Las Vegas as long as—
I think just in here with you inside the studio. I can't picture myself anywhere else.
Well, we don't have a refrigerator, but other than that, we can get you some accoutrements.
Can I picture myself out? You mean outside Vegas in a show?
Outside Vegas, or do you think you'll be here as long as Vegas will have
you? I don't know. If you asked me that 8 years ago, I probably said, no, I'll probably be doing the road again eventually. But, you know, this town has been remarkably kind to me. I mean, they just don't open their arms to everybody and be here this long. Because I've seen a lot of acts come and go since I've been here. So I've been very lucky. They've embraced me and they've given me all the support that I could possibly ask for. So I would love to stay here as long as they'll have me kind of thing. You know, I really don't think I want to go back out on the road and do that. I like it. I love it here. I like to go home and then I get to go to the Strip and go to the best restaurants, the best shopping, the best everything.
You could do worse.
Yeah, it's a good town.
Scott Thompson is known far and wide as Carrot Top. He's been at the Luxor for 8 years now, just celebrated that anniversary, and he's headlining there through 2015. Carrot Top, it has been a delight having you
here. Thanks, Dave. Been awesome. Thank you.